Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here with you again, and I want to welcome all our listeners to the next chapter with Charlie, where we dissect strategies and tactics used by successful people to make life changes necessary for their meaningful next chapter in life. Now, today is a bit different. Today, I want to talk about a most disheartening subject, and that is mental illness and homelessness in Orange County. And I want to give special attention to the recent events in Santa Ana. You see, until recently, several hundred homeless people were living in the Santa Ana riverbed until the county forcefully removed them with no plan of restoration or providing temporary housing. And so one of the results is that hundreds of homeless people have begun moving into the main streets of Santa Ana, hugely impacting business and even tourism. My guest today is my good friend Cynthia Sitton, who is an especially experienced in this troubling chain of events. Her delightful art studio in downtown Santa Ana has become unwelcome and even frightful to anyone desiring to visit her amazing studio, located in an area that has this vigorous goal of rebuilding an inviting and professional art community. And this is certainly impairing that rebuilding. Now, Cynthia's knowledge on the subject of homelessness is very vast, because for more than a decade, Cynthia has attempted to manage the life of her very severely schizophrenic daughter, living homelessly and addicted to drugs. So without further introduction, let's welcome Cynthia. Cynthia, thank you so much for your willingness to participate in this very troubling subject. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you for asking me. Yeah, very much. Thank you.
You know, Cynthia, now for the audience, Cynthia and I are friends, and so I may say CJ every now and then. That's my nickname for her. So if I say CJ, no, I'm talking to Cynthia. I recently read, I was looking up a bit of stats in this, and the stats that I found said that there are 4,800 homeless people in Orange County. That I got a feeling that's small. And it seems that the riverbeds are a prime location for tent cities. Tell me, is there any logic to removing these tent people from the riverbeds? Because it seems their only option is to move into downtown areas where they can find good hiding places and food.
Right. Yeah.
What's the logic behind that?
Well, there isn't any. I mean, basically, you know, uninformed people, you know, that live within the city or drive by, say that, you know, the on the 5 and see the, you know, the riverbed full of people when they were there. And I read it was 1,000 people over there, but I'm sure.
Oh, well, that would be just in the river, in that one place, yeah.
In that one place. And so people complain because it is a complicated, and it is a complicated situation, and it is a problem. I mean, there's no sanitation out there, so, I don't need to elaborate on how that's a problem. You know, there can be violent situation and crime that happens. But here's my take on that. I mean, forgive me for bouncing all over. I've had a lot going on. But really, once people start complaining, then it actually puts force on the police to try to do something. And then from there, it goes, you know, to city workers, mayor, whatever, right? It keeps going up the ladder to take care of it. And bottom line, politicians want to keep their constituents happy, right? So then they're going to remove them so they're not seen, knowing full well that even from removing them, they're just going to go find hiding places, right? So it doesn't really take care of the problem. When there's not a place or plan to help these individuals out there, you know, as a next place to go, then it just, it's not even a Band-Aid. It's just a wash away. You know, then we don't have to see it. It's not as visible. My experience with working in Santa Ana in my studio is that, of course, I'm right downtown Santa Ana. The homeless have moved in more and more into the city, and it doesn't matter what corner, what bush, what you know, what area you're looking at, you're going to find somebody hiding in there, sleeping, trying to find shelter and protection for themselves. Homeless are usually at areas where they'll congregate, where they can have access to food, you know, so they're needing food, they're begging for food, asking for change, whatever they're going to do, right, to survive. So they need to be in those areas. So that's
where the dumpsters are for the restaurants, and so they can.
So they actually go forage and look for food there, and anything they can, you know, that they can find to survive. I think what most people don't know is that a good part, and I think, Charlie, even you read something about they're estimating like 40%, somewhere around there, of the people that are homeless are mentally ill. You know, I personally think it's higher because I would bulk in drug addiction into that too. And that might be controversial to some people, but I think by the time people are living on streets, completely drug addicted, you know, foraging for food or whatever, they've crossed over into mental illness, you know, to a profound extent.
I would agree with you.
But, you know, so there's a population of people that are not being treated, period, because there's no structure in our state, actually countrywide, that is in place for the mentally ill, to help the mentally ill. There's not enough hospitals. They have a huge problem with forcing people into treatment on a 5150. That seems to be becoming more and more difficult over time to even place someone on a 5150.
But that's only a three-day fix, right? Isn't a
5150 is one, I think it's 24 hours, then it goes to 48, then it goes to 72.
Right.
You know, and then at that point, it becomes more complicated to keep them in there. But, you know, back to just the homeless there in Santa Ana, you know, I think culturally we don't like to look at homeless people because they're dirty. They're kind of scary. The media has really, you know, focused on extreme cases where violence has been a problem, or, you know, something out of the ordinary, and then that creates fear in people, and then, of course, they don't want to go near them. You still have to be safe, as you would with any stranger, but I think it's just created more of a misconception of what homelessness really is, what it's like to live like that, and what it how you become that way. If you're talking about children that are ill, you know, they're wonderful to look at. They evoke so much emotion out of us and empathy that we want to nurture them and take care of them. We'll find money for them. We'll find whatever we could do. We can see what's happening in the country right now with the disgust of separating children from their families at the borders, and so, you know, it incites such emotion in people that doesn't happen with the adult, you know, and mentally ill.
It probably is probably exactly the opposite.
Right.
It's probably just disdain for the people instead of empathy.
It is disdain because by and large most people think they've made choices to end up that way. And it's not to say that some maybe have, but when you're talking about the mentally ill, and then you get into the severely mentally ill who are out there, they have not made choices to get out there. They have fallen through the cracks. Their families can't get help for them. They're uncageable, if you want to say that. Short of some type of involuntary treatment or mass outreach program, which we don't have, they're left to their own devices. And it's heartbreaking. It's completely heartbreaking.
It seems to me, Cynthia, that this move of moving homeless out of the riverbed, it seems to me, from my perspective, that it actually exacerbated the issue. Because now you didn't want to see them before because you had to drive by them. Now you have to walk next to them and eat next to them and live with them, and that wasn't part of the process when they were in the riverbed.
Yeah, well, I would say, during the days, many will leave and go then look for food, right? Or anything of that nature, right? Or cigarettes or whatever it is they're looking for that particular day, right? So they'll go into the city to do that. But so then, you might be running into a few or whatever and notice, but now it's, since they've all been moved out, their shelter is in the city too, like in pockets of the city. I mean, I was in my parking structure by my studio on the top floor where I had a good vantage point to look across the tops of other buildings. And I was watching homeless people walk from, because sometimes the buildings are very close together, like straddle from one top of the building to the next to get on top of a secure area where they can hide down with their sleeping bags and sleep for the night.
Oh my.
So they need the shelter from the elements, but also they need to keep themselves safe too, because they become they can become victimized themselves. So, I don't think people realize when they were all together, okay, it will be things that will happen amongst them, but they're not volatile out there in the public where...
Right. There's sort of a community,
really,
I would imagine.
They do have a really intricate, system of survival and code of ethics or morals, if that's even possible, when you're talking about seriously ill,
yeah.
Because that can change on a dime. But there is communities. They'll pocket into smaller ones that watch out for one another in their own way, and that is because they've been left on their own. So they know places to go where they're more apt to get food, and then where to stay away from, and it's just the other problem is by forcing people out and moving them into new areas, right, just by virtue of them trying to go walk to a newer area, they then move into maybe somebody else's territory, and then that causes a problem. So it's not as easy, as people might think reading it. We'll just get them out of there, and then they have to get themselves together and do something. They don't know how to get themselves together.
That's
There's nothing
right.
available for them to figure out how to get themselves together. There's less people out there who have just lost their home and they're parking and out there for the time being than there are mentally ill, and drug addicted people.
The ones that could possibly do something, there's just so few of them.
There's a fair amount of programs for people that are high functioning,
right.
So you can in different cities that will work in outreach with people that might need a temporary place to stay, and then maybe some access to jobs or whatever that the city might help them with. So there's pockets of programs, but that doesn't service the severely mentally ill, not even remotely.
Now that you've brought that up, I want to make a little segue, because I think you have told me such horror stories of the mentally ill with your daughter And I'd like to talk about that and your experience with the authorities, with mental institutions, and the stories you've told me have just been horrifying. Now, first thing I want to say is that your daughter, as I seem to recall, displayed no symptoms of mental illness until she was about 13. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. 12, 13.
And then she developed. Can you describe how severe is her schizophrenia?
Yeah. When it started, when she was younger, it comes on in strange ways that you, as a parent that had never been around anybody with mental illness, specifically schizophrenia, you don't really know what to look for, and it can manifest in strange behavior. And when you're dealing with a teenager who isn't strange, right? So, you know, I was assuming that she was dabbling in drugs and doing things of that nature, because she couldn't be as strange as she was behaving unless under the influence of something. You know, she had stories that were, you know, far too impossible to actually be real, you know, associating herself with people that she would see in the newspaper. Oh, I know them, and I know them, and I ran around with them the other day, and I full well knew that she was with me. And so there were starting to become evidence of, like, something is not right, you know, and blood tests later and all that shows, no, she's not on drugs. So, therapy is going to try to get, you know, some kind of guidance from, you know, the health system. And being naive myself, you know, we weren't going to top doctors, and they
weren't diagnosing it correctly.
They hadn't diagnosed her, because it is very hard at first to diagnose, especially with somebody young. It isn't like, you know, she can't carry on a conversation. But when you keep talking, you start realizing some of it's diluted, right? Some of it is so not in touch with the reality and so couldn't have happened that there's something going wrong with her brain. So I had a lot of misdiagnoses, and then eventually it was getting worse. She was getting violent. She got in trouble at school. We were getting kind of thrown from therapist to therapist. You know, like, you're just bad parenting. You should have a contract with her, or do all this, you know, do this and that. She'll be fine. Nothing was working. You know, you can imagine the stress that was causing on
like
the family.
She's a normal person, and you just need to do normal parenting.
Right. So, you know, long and short, she ended up stealing my car. This was after finding her. She disappeared for a little bit. We found her in San Diego.
How old was she at this time?
14? 15, maybe?
Okay.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at my records, because that's the other thing. Living with somebody ill for that long, it's been 20-something years now, you kind of lose track. I mean, my concept of time is obliterated. But anyway, She, you know, stole my car, fell asleep on the freeway. Of course, she didn't have a driver's license, hit another car. They called us. And then at that point, I pressed charges to put her in juvenile hall, because I knew at that point she was going to kill herself or kill somebody else. So that was the only thing I had left to do at that point, because I was asking medical professionals, you know, for help, but there really wasn't any help available. You know, give her this med, give her that med. But in the meantime, we're kind of running, you know, our own insane asylum at home, right? And I have two other small kids, so we're trying to get help for her. But so while she was in juvenile hall, away from, you know, anything that they could suspect as drugs, she's testing clean of drugs. She was then diagnosed with schizophrenia. So, you know, since that time, she's been more than 35 hospitals. Some long-term, some short-term, you know.
No, what is long-term and short-term? What does that mean?
Short-term, like there's different levels. There's not many of them, because there's, you know, there was the shutdown of the hospitals in the 60s and the 80s. thinking that, you know, if they released patients,
right,
they would just kind of go into the community and the community would help them. Well, you know, that didn't happen.
Yeah, that was a brilliant idea.
Yeah, so there's a shortage of beds, but a short-term, an acute stay is basically like a 5150 or an emergency situation, like she tried to commit suicide. We've had those, all the different kinds of things. Then she goes in, and that's acute. She's only going to stay there until she's transferred to something that's a little bit longer. So maxed out, usually you only stay 2 weeks, and say, like a UCI, you know, or if she goes into St. Joseph, their psychiatric place there, she was there for a couple of weeks and then moved. Then you can go into a little bit longer of a treatment facility, which is still inpatient, which she's been into a whole bunch of them, and it's usually like a 3 to 6 month stay, so they're supposedly getting medicated and treatment, all that kind of stuff to help them adapt back into society. And then from there, if that doesn't work, there's long-term, which is usually a state hospital, which she's been in that one in Norwalk, Metropolitan State Hospital, where it can be indefinitely, and they're horrible. I got to tell you, they're horrible.
Yeah, I know that. That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. You've told me about these mental institutions, and it's unbelievable. Can you describe some of the craziness that goes on amongst the sane people there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, how I know specifically what's going on a large part of the time is when my daughter was put into Metropolitan State Hospital for the first time. She's had two durations there. And she went there because the treatment facility she was in that was supposed to be a six-month stay, she had attempted suicide, you know, too many times, was causing a lot of ruckus. Her medications weren't working well for her. She'd get into sabotaging her treatment because it just happens. You know, there's not as much counseling going on in those places as you think there are because there's so many patients per person trying to help them that it's an overload. So the contract with her, with this shorter term place, was you have to agree with us that you will not attempt suicide if you want to stay here. Well, okay, I hope everybody just gets how ludicrous that is just from hearing that. Okay, she's a mentally ill person who is suicidal, so they were almost treating it like she was choosing to be suicidal, like that was some kind of choice, right?
Right.
So, of course, it got bad, so the next step was Metropolitan, because at that point we had really been through every hospital possible, you know, with like different places bouncing around, trying to get her some kind of stability. One seemed worse than the other. Sometimes ones would be okay, but then she was too sick to be in that one and not sick enough to be in another one. And there were all these reasons why they would bounce her around. Finally ends up in Metropolitan. When I went to visit her, they accidentally let me in with my girlfriend at the time into the common area where the patients were. So I won't go into the series of events that happened that way, but basically I kept saying, I need to go to Unit 512, and then they'd say, okay, and they'd open up the, unlock the elevator, let me go up, and then I got up to the top, and I said, I'm coming to visit somebody in Unit 512. Oh, okay, they open up the door to the unit, let me in, and then there's still nobody there. So my friend and I just walked down the hall straight to the nurse's station. Nobody's paying attention to us at all. And then we walked into the common area. And in that short of time that we're there, you know, it's, you know, chairs fly across the room. There was a woman naked that was pounding her head on the side of a wall. There's, you know, it sounds like a movie, but it was.
I was going to say it sounds. This sounds like what you see in a movie, and you think,
right.
You know, and especially a movie of the 18th century, that's the way they
Well, in some ways, it hasn't got a lot better. I mean, the difference with mental institutions now, I don't know what the politically correct word is now, but psychiatric facilities, is that because of, you know, activists for human rights that were well-intentioned, you know, they felt it was inhumane to maybe strap someone down or, right. you know, any of some of the, and some of them were medieval and they were stupid and they needed to be changed. But some of them were used in lieu of over-medicating them. So because it's become so, you know, unbelievably horrific for some people to think of somebody being maybe strapped down to a bed until they're calm, now they just shoot them with so much medication that they're drooling in their chairs because that's the easiest way.
Sure.
You know, it's a medication straitjacket is what it is. So there's no treatment going on because they're over medicated. So nothing's really going to happen, but then they're not harmful because when you get into that situation, I remember walking in and a doctor or nurse, I can't remember, was walking towards me and to talk to me, and a patient walked up and just hit the doctor in the face so hard.
Oh, jeez.
And because the ratio of the caretakers to the patients is ridiculous, and they're super underpaid. So
they're not motivated.
No, it might have been 10 years ago or so, there was this mass exodus of state workers in those facilities that went to work in the jail system because they would get more pay there, and actually the mentally ill kept getting thrown into the jail systems. So the jail systems needed professional care there.
Right.
It still is the case. They're mostly jailed now because there's not hospitals. And so what's the outcome of somebody who's that out of control mentally is that they usually end up harming someone, harming themselves, but, you know, maybe vandalizing something by accident or on purpose or whatever delusion they're in at the moment.
Sure.
And then they go to jail. And then, you know, and then it just is, you know, it's then it's a whole nother set of problem there. But so Tiffany, in those places, you know, it's described to me by other people that live there. Imagine being in a place where there's no clocks on the wall, too. To find one, it's really hard, and you get only a certain amount of time where the TV's put on every day, and you're just basically bored. They're bored out of their mind, and also, it's the since I was conservator for a long period of time, and I forced myself into her treatment because legally I was allowed to, but they would really try to avoid that from happening because I would make them accountable as much as possible. I would get to see what sort of treatment in her group sessions or whatever they were, and it was ludicrous because there would be a dementia patient, a schizophrenic patient, a bipolar patient, a patient that was supposed to be in the unit for the violently mentally ill that had, you know, murdered or some horrible thing, and then that area got too overcrowded, so then they started dumping some of them into the normal units. So then you had violent mentally ill that were in the regular units, too. And now imagine all of this. I'm seeing this. I'm horrified, and I can't take her out because it will be against medical advice. She will lose all of her, you know, subsidies, whatever, you know, all the stuff that she's getting, her. You know,
is she still a minor at this time?
No. This was still an adult, but I had conservatorship, which gave me sort of, it's like a power of attorney over,
so,
right?
So life now I wanna take a break, but when I come back, I wanna talk about you at some point lost your conservatorship, right?
Yes, yes.
And things got even worse.
Right.
At that point. Let's take a break, and we're going to pick up right there.
Okay.
Okay. Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and I am speaking with Cynthia Sitton, and we are talking about mental illness and homelessness. And as Cynthia has already described, it's just tragic. But the situation gets worse. Cynthia had conservatorship over her daughter at the time, and that means she had some say and she had actual access to her daughter. But at some age, and you'll have to tell me what age, CJ, at some age you lost conservatorship and you lost total control over anything that happens with your daughter. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And that's not unlike a family where their child turns 18 and then they don't have conservatorship. I happened to get conservatorship before she turned 18, which was, you know, in retrospect, a feat all on its own. I just didn't know it at the time. And but once someone becomes an adult, they can't be forced into treatment without their own consent.
And you can't even find out. Ask them if she checks herself in. They can't even give you the information of where she's located. So you don't even know. Right. They may know where she's at, but they're not going to tell you because of her human rights.
Yeah. Well, what it works out is you know, fast forward with Tiffany. You know, I lose conservatorship through the court. Basically, I gave over conservatorship to public guardianship. I was convinced that I needed to stop being the bad guy in the situation and I needed to be her cheerleader. And quite frankly, I wanted that. I did not like always being the one that had to tell her, no, you have to stay in a hospital. It's heartbreaking. So I put that responsibility onto public guardianship, not knowing how bad public guardianship was. I had family members that didn't believe she was as sick as she was, went to lobby to get control of the public guardianship. The court denied it, but then
that wanted to take over your daughter's life?
Yeah, they didn't believe she was a lot. This happens commonly with families. They don't, you know, it's so complex. I mean, you think about it, the grieving that's involved with realizing somebody's not going to be the person they were. I'm talking seriously ill, right? There's the spectrum of all illnesses have from, you know, low to high, right? Tiffany's on the very, very high. So, you know, to realize that person isn't who they are, that's a lot to accept and to swallow. So most people divert their anger and divert responsibility onto something or someone because they just can't cope with it, right? So, you know, it doesn't excuse it, but anyway.
And then drug addiction became a part of your story as well.
Well, I would say with anybody whose kid ends up homeless, that is just a fact. It's going to happen. They're out there. They're not taking medication. They will self-medicate.
Right.
Other people are around pushing drugs. They'll get drugs. I mean, it just ends up being a fact. It's not, if they fell through the cracks and ended up homeless because nobody will take them into the hospital, they will end up doing drugs even if they didn't go into it that way. So it's just a fact.
Got it.
And so that's how it is with her. And, of course, anybody who has a mental illness that does, you know, hardcore drugs, it just exasperates it that much more. And so the person is worse and worse and worse. And, you know, schizophrenia is a progressive illness. So without treatment, it is just...
Well, it's one of the most severe mental illness that there is, is it not?
Yeah. Right. Of mental illnesses, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
It's the top. It's the one you don't want. And specifically with her, she got it very young. So it usually means it's worse. And it also denies them all of those years of maturing. So you're dealing with an adult who's basically at the emotional level of a 12 or 13-year-old.
Oh, my.
So, so the problem is that the way things have become now is that you... 5150 is supposed to be if you're a danger to yourself or others.
You know, our people probably don't know 5150, so you might explain 5150.
It's basically involuntary treatment for somebody who is exhibiting, you know, symptoms that will make them a danger to society and other people or themselves, like committing suicide, attempts, all that would put them in that area. It used to be a wide umbrella when it first, you know, was enacted, which I couldn't tell you when that was. But, you know, if somebody like my daughter is now is on the street and you called and said they're delusional, they're hurt, they don't know, you know, they need treatment, they would be able to get them in. But it's got so bad now that everybody's hands are tied because of lawsuits, because of lack of beds, because of lack of funding. You know, I could go on this list of all of these huge, you know, these complex issues that even if you took one of those problems away, you still have a myriad of other problems to deal with.
Well, you know, one thing I can't understand, and I'm sure you can explain it, but you don't understand it as well. It seems the California legislation prevents your privilege of actually being a parent.
That, oh, completely.
That because, and it's all of this so-called freedom and human rights, and that you can't invade her human rights, and she doesn't even know what they are, and all you're trying to do is feed your daughter and clothe your daughter and try to house her if that were possible, but they won't even give you the information. They tell you they can't give you the information.
Well, she landed in jail a couple times for possession or whatnot, you know, whoever she was with, and she was clearly delusional, but I'm sure they're looking at her like, well, of course she is, because she was on drugs. But when she's been in there for 2 or 3 months, she's still delusional. You know, we did work with a judge to get her case dropped for drug program because she's supposed to show up, you know, once a week. And I'm like, she's not going to show up. She needs to be in an institution. The judge dropped the charges. Then she goes back to jail. And then we had to convince the doctors in the jail to do a psych evaluation on her to then 5150 her. As soon as they 5150 her, they send her to a hospital. The warden tells me where she's gone. I call the hospital, and the hospital says, I'm sorry, we cannot tell you if she's here or not. Well, I know she's there, you know, I tell the whole story. Sorry, we can't let you, we can't do that.
And that's because of legislation.
My daughter, yes, and my daughter at this point is so paranoid and so delusional that, you know, she thinks there's snakes around her and dire wolves, and one minute she thinks she's a doctor and the next minute she thinks she calls it security, and so she's scared to death of hospitals. She sees us as the person that has always kept her in the hospital, so she does not allow us access.
So you're the bad guy.
The problem is that I have all her records, so then I do the next best thing, which everybody goes to the next logical step, which is, okay, I'm going to fax or send to you or bring to you her records so you can know the medication she's been on, the hospital she's gone to. I'm sorry, we won't accept that.
Now, they won't accept that?
No.
Oh, jeez.
And like most medical things, one hospital is not computer connected to another one, right? So if she's bouncing all over LA County in hospitals, all over Riverside County in hospitals, all over Orange County in hospitals, none of them have each other's information. So they will take somebody as delusional as her in, you know, to talk with a nurse. It's always a nurse, never a doctor at that point, to say, tell me about your history. How long have you been sick? This is somebody who thinks they're a doctor 1 minute, and snakes.
Yeah, you were telling me that yesterday, that she said she was a doctor and that she... You know what I'd like to do? Our time is getting near, and I really think...
I know,
there's a very poignant story that you told me that is just the recent story. Can you kind of briefly outline the story of Tiffany breaking her arm? And what happened? I mean, I think none of our listeners are going to believe that this is actually happening in the United States.
Yeah, I'll try to do it succinctly. You know, just here's the situation. Yeah, we go out there to find her. She moves around a lot, so sometimes we find her, sometimes we don't. She's in Long Beach, which I have found out has 6,000 homeless people now, just in Long Beach. So we go out there. Imagine we kind of know the area that she's in. And then 2 weeks ago, actually a wonderful veteran that is an assisted living there got to know us. And every time he saw Tiffany, he called us. So at this particular time he called, he said, you know, she broke her arm. He puts her on the phone. She's crying. She's in pain. And I said, stay there. We'll be there. Michael, my husband, turns around, drives, because he was halfway there anyway, drives to her. It's broken. She's deluded, will not go to the hospital, in severe pain, passes out on, you know, on the grass. Michael sneaks away, goes to the police and says, look, this is the situation that's going on over at the McDonald's over there. And they say, I'm sorry, if it's broken, you got to call the fire department. He calls the fire department. He hides because we don't want her to know we called, because right. we will lose all the right. trust we have built every week with her to try to get her some sort of treatment. So they come, paramedics ask her to stand up. They kind of wake her up. She stands up. They have a brief, couldn't last a minute conversation. They got in and left. And she
had a conversation just they didn't ask her about her arm. They didn't look at her arm. And
they asked if they could take her in for treatment, and she said, no, it's fine. I'm a doctor. I'm fine. Whatever thing she said, but that is enough for them. They can't take her. Okay, because, okay, then fast forward a week later, we go out, we find her again. Her arm looks different. She won't show it to us. Finally, at some point, she takes a paper towel off, and there's a quarter-size hole in her arm where probably the bone is broke through that is full of pus. And the red is traveling up her arm, and so I'm freaking out. I'm completely concerned. She's got to go into hospital. I start to force the issue. She starts getting really psychotic. It's getting dangerous. So we take her to, there's little bits of lucidity. That's what people don't understand. It's not like it's not like she doesn't know who we are, but there's all these diluted stories meshed in with it. We take her to the pharmacy. The pharmacist is mortified and horrified, calls the cops. The cops come. We're out front. They approach her. They say, we understand you have a wound. You need to go to the hospital. She says, I'm fine. I'm not going to the hospital. And they said, can we take you right now? They ask her a couple more times. She says, no. Can we look at it? No. And then she starts to walk away, and they come to me, and they said, sorry, we can't do anything. And well, I said,
their hands are tied if she says no.
And here's the problem, okay? If they 5150 her, okay, you know, there's two things. They can be charged with kidnapping if they take somebody against their will. A 5150 is supposed to allow the police or whoever to take somebody in against their will because they're psychotic, a danger to themselves or others. But that has narrowed so far, because even when they take them to the hospital, there's no beds. The hospital knows they're not going to get money. The person doesn't want to be there, so they're violent. It's very difficult to take care of. So sometimes the hospital just says no, and then the cops have them there. What do I do with them now? And so sometimes if something has happened warranted to take them into jail, that's a good option, because then they'll go into jail and then somebody will 5150 them there. But usually they end up just having to drive them somewhere and drop them off. And then everybody looks at the police like it's their fault. They can't do anything about it, because as you keep going up the system, it's broken, every single level of it. And there's thousands and thousands of people needing treatment, and it's just not happening. You know.
So
and,
Cynthia, let me ask you this, and I don't assume that you have an answer to this question. if you were czar of the homeless and mental illness, what would be one of the first two or three things you think could really help this situation?
I'm not an authority and know how politics work. I mean, out from a parent looking in, of course, I would feel like there should be treatment for anybody who needs it. So I'm actually somebody who believes healthcare for all, you know,
Right.
And that's a whole other subject, right?
Right.
So I feel like the, you know, there is a, I should know this, but I've forgotten the name of the term for when somebody doesn't know they're ill. Like, they're so ill, they don't know they're ill.
Right.
That should be taken seriously, and that person should be involuntary treated. And then I think the treatment need to go back to what they were before, some many, many decades ago, where it was longer. The duration was longer so that you could give the person's brain time to be on medicine, to stabilize, you know, because that just takes a long time. I think rather than a czar, I would want to be a magician, and I would like to, like, sweep across humanity to let them know what I know, like, cross the board. Like, these are, everybody out there is somebody's child. Everybody out there, you know, could be a sibling or a parent to somebody. They're broken. Their brains are broken. It's not by choice. You know, if we could just get rid of this idea that people, you know, are either inherently choosing to do this or evil or whatever, just get rid of that. That would be my wish, because then it would, there would be an empathy to try to do more. I don't think it's at all easy to fix, because it's been, well, my gosh, Rosalind Carter talked about, this was her main platform. She wanted to change mental health. This was way back before, when she was going to marry Jimmy Carter, right? Or when he was going to run for president. And she, there was an agreement between them that she would be able to work on mental health specifically. Years later, I saw a documentary of her, and she basically said, nothing has changed. And she was, and she, you know, it was, and she was just being reality based. She's lobbied. She's tried to change. It just is, you know, people, anytime any of us think we know something, need to investigate deeper, because we usually don't know.
Right.
And so we need to take the time to really understand the situation and the complexity of it. And, you know, but we're human beings, and human beings go into protection and survival mode for yourself and your family, right? So these kind of periphery, they're not periphery, they're actually inner city. These kind of people are frightening and scary, and there's misinformation about what it is.
Yeah, you know, and they're beginning to take over cities.
It's only going to get worse. It's just going to get worse and worse.
Yeah.
You know, and it'll probably, politicians will try to blame it on immigration or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
When it's like, no, these are chemically broken people. You know, they're born that way, and it manifests at a certain age. I think a lot of people think that people have done drugs and broke their brain. Is that why they're mentally ill? No, the mental illness is there, you know, and it manifests at some particular age. You know, there just needs to be campus out. There's too much. See, I could go on.
Even if it is, you know, some sort of addictive behavior, that's, you know, people don't choose to be addicts. That's not their goal in life. You know, they're not a 7-year old saying, what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, I want to be a heroin addict. You know, there's something going on. And I think, and my perception is, our culture is not getting any better at that. We're seeing it with all of these terrible things in high schools, and suicide rates are up, like, oh gosh, from the last 10 years are up like 50% or more. Yeah. You know, we're just mental health is getting to be a, you know, a very serious condition. And
100%, I mean I could say right off the bat, there just needs to be an explosion of facility. I mean, period.
Yeah.
You know, and money dumped into that, so that the doctors that go in there don't feel like a sham, because they can't truly treat the patient anyway. You know, so pay them what they're worth, and the nurses, and have enough staff so that it's not dangerous, so that, you know, they can try to do something. But that will eliminate so many off the streets right off the bat. Because there are even, you know, even when I had conservatorship and my daughter was suicidal and wanted to be in a hospital, do you know how hard it was to find a bed to get her into one.
Jeez.
Because they're overloaded with patients already. So we'd have to be put on a waiting list. And then they didn't know what to do. So they say, well, just take her home. Like, take her home? She just tried to kill herself. How can I take her home?
Oh, gosh.
So, I mean, you know, I don't want to go all over the map, but I think empathy, it really comes down to empathy and ownership of what's going on in our culture and a desire to want to be humane and you know, look at what makes us scared, look twice at it. Is really, are you getting your information from the right sources? You know, do you really know what the illnesses are? Do you really know what homeless is? But we're seeing this in every facet of our political life. So to wrap up, like, what the hell positive comes out of any of this? You know, it's heartbreaking. It's completely heartbreaking. I'm full of anger. You know, I get in, try to do something in an activist way, in some way, when I'm not tired and exhausted, but I deeply have come to care for people and deeply have changed my paradigm on everything in life, because it's, nothing is that simple. Nothing is simple.
Well, I think, you know, this kind of conversation is a thing that's it's an essential first step, and that is education. I think so many of us are uneducated that we mm-hmm. we think the homeless are homeless by choice or because they're lazy or because they're drug addicts, and it is just so much more complex than that. And that if we were to realize, you know, that the basic common desire for human dignity, that we need to be a part of that. And Cynthia, I mm-hmm. think what you've had to say has really given us a lot of information. And I, you know, I feel so badly for you, because I know you and your husband and your children are just some of the most wonderful people in the world that I know. And I just know you're doing everything possible that you can do. And I just, you know, I just wish the best for you. I love you. Thank you for coming on. Hang on. But I do want to thank you so much for spending time, vulnerable time. Thank you for your vulnerability and your openness.
No, thank you for asking me. And, you know, this was like a vent session for me. So I'm going to vent it out. You know, I could go on for 3 or 4 or 5 hours and then be exhausted, but...
Okay.
You know, if a little bit gets out there and somebody understands it a little bit different, that's the best I can do, really.
Well, you did a great job.
Thank you, Charlie. I want to
thank all our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and be sure to check us out on our website at thenextchapter.life. That's LIFE. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.
You've been listening to another edition of The Next Chapter with Charlie, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.